Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. All this week on Forum, we're listening back to shows from our archives and hearing from the Forum producers who produce them. Today, we talk with lead producer Susie Britton about my April interview with Heder Verreich, a doctor at Brigham and Women's Hospital who lives with chronic pain after severely injuring his back while in medical school. In my darkest days, says Verreich, I wasn't even sure I could ever practice medicine at all. Verreich's new book is The Song of Our Scars, all about the many ways that affect the way we hurt and about new ways to live with pain. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're playing some of our favorite episodes from the archives this 4th of July week, and we're hearing reflections and a few behind-the-scenes takes from the producers of these shows. Joining me today is Susie Britton. She's our lead producer for the hour. Hey, Susie.
Hey, Mina.
So you've chosen the show with Dr. Heder Verreich, all about pain, its biology and how we experience it. Why? What drew you to this topic?
Mina, this was a simple book pitch, and you know so much comes over the transom here at Forum, but as soon as I began reading Verreich's book, Song of Our Scars, I knew it was beautifully written, but more than that, I'm deeply drawn to subjects that all of us experience in one form or another. As he says, pain is the hallmark of consciousness among all beings, and that has really stayed with me. And, Mina, I also love it when we bring forward people who are both experts and what we call first persons, meaning that they have a firsthand experience with the topic at hand. In Heder's case, he's a medical doctor who deeply researched the physiology and biology of chronic pain and the weird and surprising ways it differs from acute pain. And he himself lives with chronic pain after a devastating back injury.
Well, I also love that we're bringing forward our producers who produce these shows. You've pitched and produced lots of shows about science and medicine. What draws you so much to those topics, Susie?
I think for me it's nice, especially in this very difficult and fraught political moment, to talk about things that actually have solutions. And as you'll hear in this segment, Verreich explains that to our nervous systems, chronic pain is more akin to an emotion. And with that understanding, he's learned to live with pain rather than constantly trying to avoid or eradicate it. And that was profound to me.
Well, thanks for sharing that and for coming on air. I know it's not your favorite thing to do.
The more behind the scenes I can be, the happier I am. But this was fun. Thanks, Mina.
Thank you, Susie, for all that you do. All right, let's listen. Dr. Verreich, thanks so much for being with us. What did happen to you when you were in medical school in Pakistan that means you now do live with chronic pain?
It started off as just another day. I was as you mentioned, I was a medical student in Pakistan. I was at the gym, and you know, as you may, I was a bit of a jock. I had been perfectly healthy until then, and so illness was more of a technical interest, was something that I was learning as a medical student, but not something that I had really lived with or felt or experienced. But that changed while I was lifting weights and. I was lifting weights on the bench when I still can remember hearing a click in my back. It was pretty loud. And for the first maybe like half a second, everything just kind of my body shut down. The weights came crashing down on my chest. I couldn't breathe. And I couldn't even ask for help. I was in such sort of panic. Until I did, and you know, the other students who were around helped me out and took me to the emergency room, where you know, I think because I was known to the staff there, they took me to a side room, gave me a shot of a painkiller, and told me everything's going to be okay. And that's really what I believed as well. I think all of us experience some type of acute pain often. And I thought that this is going to be one of those things where it's going to hurt real bad at the start, and then it's going to go away, and then I'm just going to be back to doing things the way I was doing. But unfortunately, this pain did not get better.
You write so poignantly about this in your book. You say that the day that pain became a part of your life, that it became an infestation that would shape the narrative arc of your life. You also talk about how at one point you started to believe that the only way to release yourself from its vice, as you put it, would be to end your life. Can you talk a little bit about just the very dark places this kind of, you know, major shift towards something that would not go away, the dark places that chronic pain can take us?
It's a dark place, and often it's a very, very narrow place. Your life shrinks so much when you have chronic pain. And my, you know, something as simple as a staircase would give me nightmares. My life was basically my dorm room. And oftentimes that was it. And unless you came to see me there, there's no way that I would be able to go out and see you or do all the things I love doing. And I, you know, I had these dark thoughts about, well, how is this pain going to end? And I came to a point where I felt like that it was such a part of me at that point, that it was so much a part of my existence, that it was, that the only way that I could find relief was to release myself from that existence. And it was really hard. And, you know, I still think about that dark time, and I'm glad to report I'm better. I'm way better. But it took a long time and took an army and a whole lot of good luck. Things that so many other people with chronic pain just don't have.
Well, I want to get into some of that. But one of the things that I was really struck by was, as bad as your pain was and is, you also called it in your book unremarkable, in that you are far from unique. And you talk about how an estimated 1.5 billion people live with chronic pain worldwide, including 1 in 5 Americans. Could you help us understand first what pain is in the scientific sense of the word?
Pain is something, even though we experience it so often, and even though we, you know, as physicians, it's the most common reason why people come to the hospital seeking any type of care. It's something that's actually not very well understood, although I do think that that's changing. And if you look at the definition of pain, which was just redefined not too long ago, it's basically defined as, and I quote, "an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with or resembling that associated with actual or potential tissue damage." And you can just see in that definition how many times the committee members who helped define, came up with this definition, had to hedge, because pain doesn't follow any rules. Pain is as much a sensation that you feel in a body as it is an emotion that you feel, as much as a recurring memory or a traumatic memory ricocheting around in your brain. And what the science suggests is that pain is perhaps the most complex experience that we as human beings ever feel. It is something that is shaped by so many forces much bigger than us. Forces like racism, forces like sexism, forces like politics, forces like imperialism, forces like the relationship between a patient and their witness, and whether that witness is their caregiver, their loved one, or a physician.
So pain is both a physical and a psychological state, like a physical sensation and a psychological state at the same time, you're saying?
So this is the part where I'm going to drop some jargon, but I'm going to make it. So just fair warning.
I'm sure you'll explain it. Yes.
So if you think about what happens, so unlike, say, for example, when we see something, light is something that exists in nature, but pain is not something that exists in nature. We can feel things that we touch, but then there's some things that we touch that turn that the body deems noxious, as you may. And so the purely physical sensation that detects physical damage or unpleasant physical things in our environment is something called nociception. And nociception is an unconscious experience. It is not something that you feel. But nociception, say, let's say someone pricked you in the shoulder with a needle. Those signals will go in your nerves through your up your spine into your brain. And there the brain is going to put all its energies in creating the pain experience. And this is an experience that is as much informed by that physical sensation, but as much as by your emotional state, the context of what happened. So let's say that pin was something, you were walking in a dark alley and you feel something sharp in your shoulder. Your reaction and how you feel might be extremely different. But let's say you were getting a vaccine and someone knew what was going on. You may feel, that might feel very, very different. Your reaction to it may be very, very different. And you know, one of the things that happens to pain, and so most of the times we think about nociception will lead to pain, but that is not always the case. In fact, you know, one of the most important studies that was ever done in this field was done at the time of World War II. There's an anesthesiologist, Henry Beecher. He was stationed in Italy in a field hospital, and he started surveying soldiers who were returning from the battlefront with massive injuries. And he found that 60% of those reported no pain, even though they had gaping wounds, they had, you know, their skin was ripped off, etc. And yet there are other conditions in which you may not have nociception per se, but you may feel pain. So think about, say, phantom limb pain, in which, for example, people who've had amputations can have can really have these recurrent traumatic experiences of pain in limbs that have long sort of left them. And one of the interesting things here is that people who have had a traumatic amputation, so for example, like a soldier in a minefield who loses his leg, is much more likely to develop phantom limb pain than, say, someone who's never had a leg to begin with, etc. So that moment, that the trauma that your body absorbs in that moment, is something that can recur in your body and can be felt in your body and in your mind. Yes. For years and years, much after that incident. And in fact, this decoupling, if you may, between pain and nociception, between what you feel in your brain and what is coming from beneath, is perhaps most clear in patients who have chronic pain, because at some point the body just learns that experience. The experience of pain becomes so indelibly painted into our memory that we don't even need anything coming from downstairs to stimulate the response in our minds.
Well, I would love to explore more about chronic pain, which we'll do after the break. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about pain, the science that underlies it, how we experience it, with Heder Verreich, author of The Song of Our Scars, The Untold Story of Pain, which is actually out today. He's a physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And I want to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. How has pain affected your life Or what would you like to better understand about the science of pain? You can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can reach us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at KQED Forum. You can email us forum@kqed.org. Just before the break, Dr. Verich, you were talking about how pain is sensitive to context and how our brain really has a central role, I think you were describing, in shaping how we feel pain. And one of the things you do say in your book is that chronic and acute pain are distinct things and the brain treats them differently. Can you explain what you mean by that?
One of the studies that I found extremely interesting and one of the questions I really wanted to understand was what makes one type of pain turn into chronic pain? Why did my injury that day become chronic pain when others hadn't? I think my first sort of hunch was that maybe it was the severity of the injury that I had had. And it turns out that that's actually not true. When researchers have looked at that specific question, they found that the severity of the initial injury has very little relationship with whether someone goes on to develop chronic pain or not. The other thing was, well, maybe it was all the horrific findings they saw on my MRI of my back, which found that I had this disc prolapsing and was jutting into my spine, etc. And yet, researchers have found that those types of abnormalities, even things that sound pretty bad like a prolapsed disc, is actually found very commonly in folks who are just walking, who are just totally normal, have never even had any issues with their back. And so this is one of the fundamental things that, and especially talking to researchers who've done the research, one of the things that I would like to, that the science does not support is that that chronic pain is simply acute pain prolonged. It does seem to have a very distinct phenotype, if you may, or a distinct character, not just in how it affects us as human beings, but also the signature of chronic pain in the brain can be very different. So one study that was done by Vanya Apkarian, who is a scientist in Northwestern, showed that as people's pain turned from acute to chronic pain, the parts of the brain that were more responsible for that experience turned initially from the parts of the brain that are more associated with sort of more physical sensations or with just the where and whens of pain to more emotional aspects or places in our brain that are handle things like fear and anxiety and trauma. And all those things appear to be much more involved in chronic pain than they are in acute pain. And this is one of the reasons why I think we've had so much difficulty in treating patients with chronic pain, is because we just automatically assume that a lot of our therapies that work so well for patients who are acutely in distress would also work for patients who are in distress for a longer period of time. Mm. But as we've seen, that's not really the case. In fact, many common therapies that work very, very well for people who are in acute distress don't seem to help as much for people with chronic pain. So it does seem like there is a significant difference between them, and it's not just that one happens over a shorter period of time versus the other.
Well, the listener Curtis writes, "For 3 years, my partner experienced chronic pain in her neck and arms that affected every part of our lives. We got to the point where we tried cortisone injections near her spine, and we got close to deciding on spinal fusion surgery. Then one day, we randomly came across some YouTube videos that led us to the book Healing Back Pain by Dr. John E. Sarno, now deceased. Just reading this book ended up eliminating 90% of her pain. The upshot, the mind and body are connected. The unconscious mind can cause pain in the body, and just this knowledge can provide a lot of relief." And then this other listener tweets, regarding dealing with chronic pain, don't dwell on it. I think these two comments are interesting because they're bringing up a couple of things that you're raising. One, of course, is that the mind and the body are connected on this. But I'm also reminded of how you described when you were writing this book and you just really going through the process of thinking deeply about pain. And it was very consuming that your own physical pain seemed to worsen and you wondered if they were connected.
It's, you know, pain is the loudest alarm in our body. As soon as it goes off, the function of pain is to direct all of your energies towards it and making sure that we do everything we can to relieve ourselves of it. So attention is the fuel that fires up pain. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why the COVID-19 pandemic has just been, for some people, has been so horrific. People who are living with chronic pain is because, and, you know, I've been talking to patients and I've been reading up what they're writing. You know, patients are saying, I've had nothing left to think about other than my pain. Because of social isolation, people have been more focused on their bodies. And this is something that I experienced myself. I think most writers would say that writing a book can be a pain. But in my case, it was a literal sensation. Yes. Because as I mentioned, after years of physical therapy and really changing my lifestyle completely, I'd been able to get the pain under control, even though it shaped so much of my life and prevented me from doing many things that I wanted, like doing. But during this course of this book, I had so much pain. I had of all sorts. None of it really made biological sense. And a part of me began to think that maybe it was because I had been obsessing about pain and going back to those days when I was in pain so often and so frequently that the echo of those distressing moments had returned back to haunt me. But I think what your listeners are saying is absolutely true. The first thing here is that pain is not just something that an individual experiences. It affects every single piece of their life, their caregivers, their employment, their ability to work, their ability to and really who they are as members of society. But also, that pain is something that attention only worsens, which is why some therapies like hypnosis, for example, if you're hypnotizable, can be a real bomb for patients in chronic pain.
Yet at the same time, when someone dismisses our pain, it's also deeply painful or can exacerbate our pain. I think you even touched on this earlier in the conversation when you talk about how pain is racialized and gendered, because we also hear so often that women and people of color have their pain dismissed.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the most fascinating, well, not fascinating, one of the most deeply disturbing studies that I read was a study that was published in the journal JAMA Pediatrics, and this was a study of children with acute appendicitis. So acute appendicitis is a very common condition, extremely painful, and one would think that if we would be biased in who we give pain medications to, it would not be for a condition like appendicitis, which is short-lived, very well-known, can easily be diagnosed on a CT scan, and yet the chances that a Black child in severe pain would get strong painkillers like opioids, which are perfectly reasonable in this condition, in fact recommended in this condition, as opposed to a white kid, is only about a fifth. And so if you've lived, and we see this across the board, especially for conditions, both for minorities, but also for women, that especially when you have a condition that we don't have a blood test for, which won't show up on a CT scan, which doesn't have some type of classic finding, then if the only thing physicians are left with is your word as a patient, then our deepest biases unfortunately come into play, and which is why if anything there's been this body of evidence which actually suggests that Black people in fact have a lower threshold for pain. And yet there was this really interesting experiment that was done in which the researchers for a change actually had a Black researcher study patients instead of the usual white researcher, and found that once you had someone who was of the same race or who looked the same as you, that difference went away. And so if you've always been delegitimized when you go to the doctor, when you always had to prove how authentic what you feel is, it's going to create a huge fracture in how much you trust the system and how well the system can treat you. And certainly it's very, very clear we're failing every patient or most patients in chronic pain, but especially women and especially racial and ethnic minorities.
Dr. Viraj's book is The Song of Our Scars, and we've got calls coming in. Let me go to Natalia in Oakland. Hi, Natalia.
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for having me ask this question.
Thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
Well, today's topic really speaks to me as someone that has a chronic condition. I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a genetic condition that affects all of the connective tissue and pretty much the way our whole body is built. And I was wondering if your guest could speak a little bit on the topic of how expectations affect pain. And just to give you an example, for example, people with Ehlers-Danlos suffer many types of symptoms and a lot of different types of chronic pain. But when asked, I would always say that the worst one is the one that you experience for the first time or the newest type of pain, because you don't know what to expect. Like the first time I had costochondritis, just an inflammation in the chest and the sternum, I thought I was going to die. Each breath I took was the worst. And since then, I've had way worse flare-ups of that, but they were not the worst that I've experienced because I knew what to expect. So I was wondering if there's any studies or anything to back this up. Yeah, because, you know, when it's a crisis, a one-time thing, you know there's hope. But when your brain goes into those dark places that your guest spoke at the beginning that I know very well, it's when you don't know what to expect or whether there's hope or a light at the end of a tunnel.
Natalia, thanks. What do you think, Dr. Viraj?
Natalia, thank you so much for calling in, and I hope you... I hope you can. Your disease gives you as much respite as it can. Anticipation, expectation, memory. I mean, these things are so connected to how we experience pain. Because one of the first things that pain does, and one of the emotions that pain is most deeply related to, is fear. And the reason that is the case is because pain is at its heart a teacher, and it is there to protect us. That is why. As we have evolved, we have actually become even more exquisitely sensitive to pain because our body has developed even more sensitive ways to make sure that we don't make mistakes, so that we don't grab that hot skillet or we don't poke our fingers into the electrical socket. And anticipate. And so one of the things that I think it's really important, especially if physicians, for example, know that the pain is not from a life-threatening condition, then that we made that clear and we reassure patients that you don't have to fear this pain, as distressing as it may be. But the opposite can be true as well. I mean, we know that people who've had, for example, some type of trauma in the past, whether that's a sort of classic medical type of trauma, such as if they've had a heart attack, the next time they have pain, they're going to take it a lot more seriously. It might actually cause them a lot more distress. They might be much more likely to call 911. But even other forms of trauma, such as people who've grown up and experienced childhood abuse, childhood abuse is actually one of the most common sort of factors that can turn acute pain into chronic pain. And so yes, I mean, as much as that the pain matters, what we're experiencing in the moment, that experience is shaped so much by everything that happened to us before.
Let me go to caller Eileen in Mill Valley. Hi, Eileen.
Hi. I just wanted to say that one of the ways that my chronic pain, which is migraine, which I have 24/7 for 56 years now, and I've experienced, or people have told me, is that when they first see me, they're put off. Because my pain shows in my face. It shows in terms of tension, and that puts people off. And I try to relax my face as much as I can, but I'm not real good at it. And so once you get to know me, they find out why my face looks like that. But it does have get that reaction in people. And I just wanted to share that.
Eileen,
unfortunate side effect of it.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And I'm sorry that just on top of what you're experiencing with regard to migraines, that is also something that you experience as well. And it reminds me, Dr. Verreich, of another point you made, which is that pain is a social experience. Can you talk a little bit about that and your reaction to what Eileen is sharing?
Yes. I think there's this narrative around pain that pain is incommunicable. In fact, it's been written that pain is something that, you know, language falls short of. And I don't know about that. It may be the case for some, but one of the most important things that pain yearns for is to be witnessed, to be seen by others. In fact, you know, if you look at all the animal research that is done, which is where most pain research is able to be done ethically, or at least semi-ethically, the only way that that the researchers can see if the animal is experiencing discomfort is through their behaviors. And so I'm not surprised that people can see that you are in pain, that you're in distress, but their reaction to that seems to be so toxic. I think that pain can be such a huge stressor on so many relationships, and I've as part of the book, I spoke to caregivers of people who take care of patients with pain to understand just, you know, what are the things that chronic pain can do to relationship, and it is one of those things. It's this invisible epidemic. As much as we talk about the fact that, you know, 1 in 5 Americans and people around the world live in chronic pain, it can have a sort of enormous reaction beyond just that individual. Although I do hope that people will become more empathetic about chronic pain. I do hope that people will see and view disability in a different way than they have in the past. And hopefully we'll be able to get over some of the stigma that is associated with this condition.
Yes, you're really talking about the paradox that pain, as you say, sort of needs to be performed to be recognized, yet at the same time, it can take, I think, as you say, a person's community away from them, depending on how others react to that pain and are often turned off by seeing others in pain, unless they're, say, a spouse or somebody who feels deeply connected to them.
It's again, pain is all about context. I mean, there's studies showing that, you know, men, when they are when they're being studied for their pain by around women who are deemed attractive, that they're less likely to show their pain. But if they're around someone who they love and they trust, etc., that they're more willing to be expressive about it. I mean, we see this. And this is not just something that's restricted to humans. Even in animal research, we've seen something that's similar. But yes, it is a disability. It is, in fact, the most common cause of disability in the world. Just back pain alone is the number one cause of years lost to disability, not just here in the United States, but around the world. And I hope that we can start hearing these stories more so that we can develop the empathy needed.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking this hour about the physiology of pain and also the social and cultural experiences that shape the way we hurt. We're talking with Dr. Heather Verreich, author of The Song of Our Scars, also a physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the VA at Boston Healthcare System, and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. If you'd like to join the conversation to tell us how pain has affected your life, maybe what's made it worse or what's helped even, you can also ask any questions you'd like about the science or treatment of pain that you want to better understand. Our phone number is 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum at kqed.org. You can also post your thoughts on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at KQED Forum. Let me go to caller Bob in Cuyama Valley. Hi, Bob.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's a very interesting conversation to me. I grew up in a home with neglect and poverty, and dental care was somewhat lacking. And I suffered in my teenage years. I had actually three teeth that fillings fell out, and I was too embarrassed to mention because of the expense and everything, the way people talked about dental expense in my house. So I just didn't report it, and I just lived with it. And it was very painful. And that was one experience I had. And then the emotional pain. I think emotional pain might even be worse. Then later in my young, early 20s, I I took care of all that when I became an adult and got a job, paid my own expenses, and matured, you know, normally and naturally. But then I got involved with yoga, and I lived for about 4 years in an ashram. And I wasn't seeking any, you know, special insights into pain. I was just, you know, pursuing a spiritual course. And but during that time, I had to have some dental work, and it happened to be a root canal. And I remember the dentist saying, "Well, you're very unusual in your response to pain." I said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "Well, when I get close to the root, most people's eyes, the pupil dilates. Yours, it closed down." And then later, other circumstances, people told me, you seem to have a high tolerance to pain. Now, my pain is not spine. I know people who have that. There's other kinds of pain. I'm just talking about my own experiences, two different phases of my life, and the mental adjustment. I became a much more spiritual person, not just through the yoga and stuff, but subsequently, and just my own attitude somehow. I'm a different person, and pain, I experience pain differently. So my pain is not everybody else's. I get that.
Well, thanks for sharing your story, Bob. I'd love to get your thoughts on the types of things he's sharing, because it does touch on different things that you discuss in your book, Dr. Verreich.
So, thank you, Bob, and I'm sorry to hear about the rough experiences growing up, but so glad to see that you've taken control of your life. That's amazing and beautiful. I think what Bob is saying is, I think, reflective of what I've talked to everyone about, patients, physicians, is that really your whole life comes to affect your threshold for pain. And even things like epigenetics can come into how your experience might be different than another. There have been studies in which people have looked at twins, for example, and have seen how because of different life experiences that they've had, their threshold for pain is actually different, and it's shaped by their circumstances. It's shaped by their environments and interactions and the choices that they made or were made for them. And so really, but I do want to say that I think we have, you know, also developed this culture in which this sort of high threshold for pain has really become this, I think many people will, patients who will report being in pain, they will be judged because, oh, they don't have a high threshold, they're weak, etc. And I don't see that there's any special value in being able to withstand pain. Pain yearns to be communicated, pain yearns to be shared, and in fact, as we evolve, we are going to increasingly become more sensitive to pain, because that's the only thing evolution cares about, is making sure that we report all threats, that we detect all intruders, and that we are as xenophobic as possible with regards to any type of foreign threat within our bodies. And I hope that physicians can be respectful of that, and that we as a society don't see equate sort of having this quote high threshold for pain as being a value judgment on people.
Yes. It's interesting the way that Americans uniquely deal, or our culture of pain, the things that we value, the things we don't, and our desire really to try to avoid and eradicate it is also contribute just to the way that, that pain is treated. I mean, Sue writes, for example, do opiates work for chronic pain? If so, why is it not okay for everyone with chronic pain to get opiates from their doctor for the rest of their life?
So that's a that brings me into talking about opioids. And really, I mean, I think America has a very special and sort of challenging relationship with opioids. Americans constitute 5% of the world's population and consume about 30% of the world's opioid supply. And American mm-hmm. physicians are much more likely to prescribe opioids for conditions that few other conditions are. I mean, one study I was looking at is that American dentists, for example, are 37 times more likely to prescribe opioids than British dentists, for example. And yet, people who were prescribed opioids by their dentists are actually more likely to report pain. And in fact, if you look at the highest quality data that we have for patients with chronic pain and the use of opioids, and this was a randomized trial that was published in JAMA called the SPACE trial. It was actually performed at the VA. It showed that people who were actually getting opioids instead of other safer pills such as NSAIDs or ibuprofen were actually, the patients with the opioid group were more likely to have more intense pain than in the other group. And part of this is because that we develop very quick tolerance and dependence on opioids, that our body's receptors multiply and that the same supply just doesn't do it for us. The other thing is that our bodies innately have this really rich system of making their own opioids. In fact, you know, And those are central to our way of being. These opioids are the reason why most things actually don't hurt us. Like I'm sitting on this chair right now, and it doesn't hurt my back right now in this moment, or even other things such as things that give us joy. So, for example, when a mother holds her child, for example, that feeling of goodness that they feel is actually in part mediated by the opioids that our body itself makes, to give us that feeling of warmth and of tenderness and social connectedness. Hmm. And yet when we take an opioid, the dose that we get in a pill is so much higher than anything that our bodies can create. Not only do opioids rob us of our ability to manage our everyday aches and pains over time, but they actually take away that ability to feel joy and warmth and social connectedness. Having said that, I do think that there are patients for whom opioids work. And that we should not take a blunt approach towards getting people off of opioids, because that also can be dangerous if we do not offer people alternatives. But I think this just goes to show that if we continue to treat acute chronic pain like acute pain, we're going to have missteps. And one of those missteps certainly was how much opioids were prescribed in this country for chronic pain.
Well, Lloyd writes, has Dr. Verreich tried acupuncture? Like many of my traditional Chinese medical doctor colleagues, I went into it because of my own pain and illness. Patients see me for pain all the time. The psychological interconnection of physical pain and emotion is well documented by Chinese medicine journals that date back thousands of years. Modern researchers have observed that acupuncture has the ability to, quote, rewire and heal the neural pathways that deal with pain and dysfunction. So, Dr. Verreich, what are sort of better ways to treat chronic pain? Is acupuncture one of those things? You mentioned hypnotherapy earlier. You're also mentioning sort of touch and empathy. What are you finding as you look into this more deeply?
So before I start, I think it's what's important. One of the things that I've come to is that there's no one silver bullet for pain. And I don't think that there ever is going to be one, but that the way forward is really thinking about bringing as much options as possible for patients so that we can give them the widest array of options and figure out which one might help. But there are some therapies that I think and some approaches that I work that work better than other. And let me use acupuncture as an example. So this was a trial that was, to me, was, I think, so eye-opening. So this was a trial of acupuncture versus something called sham acupuncture, in which they basically showed that they did maneuvers that were similar to acupuncture, but didn't really follow the practice. And they found that the professionally performed acupuncture was not better than the sort of simulated acupuncture. But what they did then was they had a third arm in the trial, and this was called enhanced acupuncture. And in this, what the person performing the procedure did was that they didn't just do the procedure, but they talked to the patient. They asked them how they were doing. They asked them about their day. They asked them about how the procedure was making them feel. They really, really connected to the patient using a guide that had been created to sort of show empathy, to model behaviors that would engender a sense of kindness. And suddenly this group did so much better than any other group. And I think it goes to this idea that, you know, we've all heard about the placebo effect, which can be extremely profound. And one of the interesting things is that the placebo effect, especially in America, is actually going up over time, suggesting that we are becoming increasingly suggestible to medical intervention. But the secret sauce in the placebo is the physician and the nurse and the clinician who's seeing the person in pain and attending to their needs, showing that they care, going out of their way to make them feel heard or seen. And which is why I think one of the goals of medicine should be that we should try and enhance our own placebogenic qualities as physicians, as nurses, to think about how can we provide people more comfort. In fact, the placebo effect is so strong that even when patients are told that what they are receiving is a placebo, when they're given a medicine that has a label placebo on it, but if it is done in an environment that is kind and empathetic and compassionate, that patients actually get a significant benefit just from that medical ritual rooted in empathy. So I really do think that kindness and empathy have a very, very important role to play if we are going to get over, if you're going to help people in chronic pain. And you can incorporate empathy and kindness in any practice. So let me give you another example. One of the things that I believe in extremely strongly is exercise and the role of exercise in overcoming chronic pain. And in one clinical trial, what they did was, and this trial was interesting because it actually had a patient who was part of designing the trial. There was a group of physical therapists who were sort of traditionally trained. But then they had another group that had been trained in what's called acceptance therapy. Now, acceptance therapy is a form of cognitive behavioral therapy in which what you do is instead of having the patient focus only on the pain and only on controlling the pain, it shifts their focus to having them live their life to the fullest despite the pain, living with their body in pain and yet doing as much as they can to do the things that they like doing that give them joy. And what they found was that this more enhanced type of physical therapy that was rooted in acceptance therapy, and again, these were not professional therapists, the patients in this arm did so much better. In fact, they needed less exercise, less sessions, because they're having a much better response. So really, I think exercise is going to be vital, although for many patients, exercise or physical therapy can be expensive. Many people, it's hard to get out of home. So thinking about online options or telehealth options for physical therapy is going to be really, really important. Acceptance therapies really, I think, has to be at the heart of any approach that we have for patients with chronic pain. And some of the best conversations I've had and some of the things I learned most were actually from pain psychologists. And again, these are people who help pain specialists and work in an interdisciplinary environment to help people live better despite the pain. And I think that's something that we'll just have to incorporate in our practice as patients, but also as a health system.
We're exploring pain with Dr. Heder Verreich, and you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Just underscoring your point about accessibility and affordability, Jessica writes, I'm a primary care physician who ran a pain group and had many chronic pain patients at my clinic. The most heartbreaking thing was how few alternatives to opioids these patients had. These were all Medi-Cal or Medicare patients with limited financial resources, so they had very little access to acupuncture, massage, chiropractic treatments, and not much in the way of physical therapy either. Go ahead. It sounds like you want to comment.
I feel like I could have written this question myself, because the when I say that we lack in empathy, it's not just interpersonal empathy, but our entire health system lacks it. And we know that if you create a model that is patient-centered, that patients are going to do better. And I'll give you an example that exists right here in this country, which is the VA health system, which I work for. So in the United States today, there are only 74 accredited pain rehab centers in the entire country. And yet, one of the leading sort of sources of high-quality pain care is the VA, and the VA transformed itself. The VA used to be at the forefront of prescribing opioids, but when they realized the harms, they did a reevaluation. And what they then invested a lot of their resources in was, in fact, doing exactly that, providing patients resources like access to exercise, like access to acupuncture, like access to hypnosis, and in fact, which now means that the VA has become the leading or the best health system for patients with chronic pain and have been able to reduce safely the number of their patients taking opioids to a very, very great extent. So it is doable. This is not just a pipe dream. We can have a health system that puts patients ahead of profit, that centers itself in kindness and empathy. Yet, what we're seeing is that it is much faster to give a prescription and much more lucrative to do a procedure. What you don't have to show is whether any of those approaches help. And yet the evidence-based approaches that I've just mentioned are the ones that insurance companies will give a lot of pushback for, or that patients will have to pay a pretty high copay for, or that we just don't have enough because, again, they're not well reimbursed the way other interventions are, and they just don't make financial sense. And so I really hope that to help get over this, it's not just going to be doctors and nurses just deciding today that, oh, they're going to be kinder to chronic pain patients, because that's what we want to do. But we also want to work and live in a health system that incentivizes that, that makes it easier for us to do exactly that.
Well, Tank writes, as an assigned female at birth person with multiple chronic conditions, I've taken my decades of negative experiences regarding my pain and turn them into helping my patients with theirs. I listen to them. I believe them. I'm empathetic. I don't rush them. I hold space for them. This alone leads to better outcomes. In many ways, Dr. Verreich, as you say in your book, you're hoping to move us to a future in which even if we hurt, we don't suffer. And I appreciate you being on today. Thank you so much.
No, thank you so much for having me talk about this. And I really hope that this book becomes a vehicle that allows us to help patients in chronic pain be better.
Dr. Heather Verreich, a physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the VA Boston Healthcare System, also an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. His new book is The Song of Our Scars, The Untold Story of Pain. Thank you, Dr. Verreich. Thank you, listeners, for sharing your experiences and also your questions and comments. And my thanks to Susie Britton, who produced today's segment. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.